from Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar. The historic 7th Summit of the Americas ended Saturday evening in Panama. For the first time in more than five decades, the U.S. and Cuba spoke directly to each other at the presidential level, with President Raul Castro meeting with his U.S. counterpart Barack Obama. President Obama called the rapprochement with Cuba, quote, a turning point for the entire region, closed quote.
This is obviously a historic meeting. The history between the United States and Cuba is obviously complicated, and over the years, a lot of mistrust has developed. During the course of the last several months, there have been contacts between the U.S. and the Cuban government. And in December, as a consequence of some of the groundwork that had been laid, both myself and President Castro announced a significant change in policy and the relationship between our two governments. I think that after 50 years of a policy that had not changed on the part of the United States, it was my belief that it was time to try something new.
The Cuban president likewise expressed both good feelings and some concerns.
Well, Mr. President, friends from the press, we have been making long speeches and listening to many long speeches too. So I do not want to abuse the time of President Obama or your time. I think that what President Obama has just said, it's practically the same as we feel about the topics, including human rights and freedom of the press. We have said on previous occasions to some American friends that we are willing to discuss every issue between the United States and Cuba. We are willing to discuss about those issues that I have mentioned and about many others as these, both in Cuba, but also in the United States. To this date, the commercial, economic, and financial blockade continues to be applied in all its intensity against the island. It causes harm to the people, and it is an essential obstacle against our economic development. It constitutes a violation of international law, and its reaches affects the interests of all countries. It is not coincidental the unanimous vote against the blockade, almost unanimous, not including Israel and the United States, at the United Nations during all these years.
Aside from Presidents Obama and Castro, among those in attendance were Evo Morales, the President of Bolivia, Rafael Correa, the President of Ecuador, Dilma Rousseff, the President of Brazil, Cristina Fernandez de Kirchner, the president of Argentina, and Nicolas Maduro, the president of Venezuela. It was evident that a near unanimous majority of Latin American countries reject U.S. interventionism in the region, in particular in the case of Venezuela, with President Castro joining in the statement of that position. The following is a report from the Venezuelan news agency, Telesur.
The historic 7th Summit of the Americas came to a close Saturday with the majority of the leaders of the region agreeing on condemning U.S. aggressions against Latin America and in solidarity with Venezuela. President Barack Obama defended his government's position regarding human rights in the region, but was slammed by most of his colleagues. They criticized Washington for its double morale regarding human rights and for its interventionist policies around the world. The attendance of President Raul Castro marked the first time a Cuban leader was present at the summit. He called for the lifting of the U.S. blockade, but also expressed his solidarity with Venezuela.
Esteemed colleagues, Venezuela isn't, nor could be, a threat to the national security to a superpower like the United States. It is positive the United States president has recognized us. I should reaffirm all of our support in a resolute manner to the sister Bolivarian Republic of Venezuela and to the legitimate government that is led by President Nicolas Maduro, and to the Bolivarian Chavista people who fight to continue on their own path and confront threats of destabilization and unilateral sanctions that we demand be lifted. that the executive order withdrawn.
Ecuadorian President Rafael Correa harshly criticized the United States for using human rights issues to falsely justify interventionist measures against the sovereignty of Latin America and Caribbean nations. Correa said that in Ecuador, torture and the death penalty do not exist as they do in the United States. He also said that Obama's executive order against Venezuela flagrantly violates international law. Brazilian President Dilma Rousseff said her country rejects U.S. sanctions on Venezuela and called for dialogue. She said that the moment of hemispheric relationships doesn't need unilateral measures and politics of isolation, such as the ones being imposed by the United States. Rousseff added that Obama's order on Venezuela is counterproductive and inefficient. She also called on Washington to put an end to the more than 50-year blockade against Cuba and emphasized the right of each country to self-determination. Argentine President Cristina Fernandez spoke out in support of Cuba and Venezuela during her address before the 34 other regions' leaders present at the Summit of the Americas. She agreed with the numerous other presidents who refused to pander to Obama. Fernandez called the U.S. sanctions on Venezuela ridiculous. Fernandez also took the chance to condemn the U.K. for increasing its military presence in the Argentine Malvinas Islands. Venezuelan President Nicolas Maduro told the Summit of the Americas that he extends an open hand to President Obama in order to resolve their differences. But Maduro warned Obama against interfering in each other's internal affairs. He told the U.S. president he had over 11 million signatures demanding that he repeal his recent decree against Venezuela, saying that it is irrational and disproportionate. Maduro also expressed his lack of confidence in Obama.
I want to believe you, but I don't trust you. I respect you, but I don't trust you, President Obama. If you're willing, we'll talk, but if you don't want to talk, that's fine. It will be your legacy with Venezuela. The order, the silence, the predominance. I have said it several times, President Obama. Don't let things happen as they did with George W. Bush, who supported the coup against Commander Chavez. History should go another way. I extend my hand, President Obama, so that we can talk and resolve the issues we have to resolve between the United States of North America and Venezuela in peace.
Israeli authorities were urged by the UN Human Rights Office to stop the use of so-called administrative detention against Palestinians. Such detainees are held without charge or trial, often on the basis of secret evidence, for potentially indefinite periods. Catherine Hasselberg reports from the United Nations.
The Office of the UN High Commissioner for Human Rights, OHCHR, says that most recently, Palestinian Legislative Council member Khalida Jabbar was arrested and subsequently detained under an administrative order. The order is currently under review by the Ofer Military Court in the West Bank, and it confirmed Jabbar would be subjected to 6 months' detention without charge or trial. The detention could be renewed indefinitely. OHCHR spokesperson Ravina Shamdasani says this is not the first time that the Palestinian Legislative Council member has been subject to administrative orders by the Israeli military commander in the West Bank.
In August last year, Jarar received a military order giving her 24 hours to move from Ramallah, where she lives, to the district of Jericho, where her movements would be restricted for 6 months. On appeal, an Israeli court reduced the restriction to 1 month. The Israeli practice of administrative detention has been condemned on numerous occasions by the UN Human Rights Office and the Human Rights Committee, which oversees implementation of the International Covenant on Civil and Political Rights, which Israel has ratified.
OHCHR says that as of February this year, more than 420 Palestinians were reportedly held under administrative detention orders, which is more than double the 181 who were held at the same time last year. Catherine Hasselberg, United Nations.
Russia's President Vladimir Putin rescinded a ban prohibiting the delivery of the Russian S-300 missile air defense system to Iran. Iran's defense minister said Monday that Russia's decision will boost cooperation between Moscow and Tehran and could help regional stability. U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry raised concerns with his Russian counterpart, Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov, over the decision. That, according to White House spokesperson Josh Earnest Monday, who added that Russia's decision to start an oil-for-goods trading regime could also raise sanctions concerns. RT's Medina Koshnov filed this report from Moscow.
Well, the necessity for the embargo on S-300 air defense systems has fallen away as a result of relations with Iran improving and of a recent breakthrough that was reached in Switzerland over Tehran's nuclear program. Now, that's according to Russia's foreign minister, Sergei Lavrov. Now, the contract for supplying the S-300 was signed 8 years ago, but then in 2010, the embargo was introduced in a bid to stimulate the talks between the six world powers and Iran over its nuclear program. And currently, the Russian President Vladimir Putin has given a go-ahead for delivery as the sides are getting closer to reaching a final agreement and lifting sanctions. Now, the Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov said that Iran needs the S-300 due to quite a tense situation in the region, and he also stressed that the equipment in question is purely defensive and it represents no threat to nearby countries, including Israel. Now, and at the moment, all eyes are on Israel and its reaction on the news, considering the fact that the country always saw Iran as its main enemy.
A spokesperson for the Yemeni army said that over 2,000 people, including 381 children, have been killed since Saudi Arabia began its air war on the country. Colonel Sharaf Lagman said that at least 240 women were killed in the airstrikes and added that nearly 3,900 were injured in the attacks. Lachman also noted that over 1,000 homes were demolished since Saudi warplanes began bombing residential areas, government buildings, hospitals, schools, and stadiums in a number of Yemeni cities. The humanitarian situation in Yemen continues to deteriorate as the Saudi airstrikes on the country continue. Press TV's Mohammed Al-Attab filed this report from Sana'a Monday.
With the continuation of the Saudi airstrikes on Yemen, the humanitarian situation further deteriorates and people are bracing for a worst-case scenario. Long queues of gas stations at the heart of the capital, Sana'a, can be seen everywhere in the country. Many of those queuing at the gas station are in desperate need for fuel as they rely on their cars to make a living. Hussein, who used to go around the city on his pickup selling household products, has lost his sole livelihood.
I've been trying to refill the tank of my car for over 3 days. I've lost my car's reserves of fuel. I think I do not have any reason to stay in Sana'a along with my family. I just need fuel to take them back to the village and find another source of living.
The unprecedented shortage of gas also made many car drivers to abandon their vehicles and walk on foot rather than queuing on the longest ever lines of cars before the gas stations.
Such Saudi economic sanctions and crimes against humanity are liable for international trials at The Hague. Similar crimes have been committed by Israel against people of Gaza under the pretext of Israel's security. So such criminality shows the similarities between both regimes, which were created for the same agenda, serving each other.
Even though the Yemeni people are suffering from the continuation of the aerial and sea ban, they are vowing to continue their march until their country's independence is fulfilled and realized.
The situation has also led to long queues for basic food accommodation. Many observers say the tight economic ban on Yemen and Saudi Arabia's air raids that mostly target the country's infrastructure and residential areas are aimed at breaking the will of this nation and amount to war crimes. Mohammed Al-Attab, Press TV, Sana'a.
Meanwhile, Saudi Arabia again rejected a call by Iran to stop its nearly three-week-long military assault on Yemen. Press TV's Bardia Hanardar has more.
The Saudi foreign minister says that Riyadh and its allies have launched airstrikes on Yemen to help what he calls the country's legitimate authority, a reference to fugitive former president Abdrabu Mansour Hadi. Saudi Al-Faisal says the fighting in Yemen has been going on for a year and that he can't understand how Iran is asking them to stop it. Riyadh has vowed to press ahead with its military aggression against Yemen until Hadi is reinstated. It accuses Iran of interfering in Yemen's internal affairs, a claim that Tehran denies.
This past week also saw another international conference whose subject matter could bring huge changes in the present political and economic world order. that being an international conference on reparations, which was held in New York City last week. Sponsored by the Institute of the Black World for the 21st Century, it featured world leaders from throughout the African diaspora, making the case that the time has come to restore the value of the stolen labor of African people to its rightful owners. This was Professor Sir Hilary Beckles, a vice chancellor at the University of the West Indies, who also leads the Reparations Commission of CARICOM, the Community of Caribbean Nations, speaking at the closing plenary Saturday.
We have had a nice time in the last couple of days. And what we have sought to do has been to turn the world the right way up. I'm going to begin with a reference to one of the most intriguing books I have read. It is called The Autobiography of a Runaway Slave. It is not called The Autobiography of a Runaway Enslaved African. The word slave is used, and I believe that is very significant. This is the autobiography of an African in Cuba who, in the middle of the 19th century, took the decision not to be enslaved for another day. And he made the decision on the basis that my individuality cannot be celebrated in the context of slavery. And he said, I became tired of a white man on a horse telling me when to wake up, when to sleep, what to eat, what to do, 24 hours every day, day after day, every minute of my life is under the control of someone else. And I decided I have had enough of this. And he took off into the forest and spent the rest of his days in splendid isolation. A lonely man for many, many years. And he said from time to time he heard the drums in the distance, the parties on the plantation. He missed the ladies who he loved. He missed friends and family. But he decided that his individual freedom was worth more than any other asset. Then he was found walking through the forest, and he was asked, why are you here in this forest by yourselves? And he said, I am running away. And he was asked, running away from what? He said, I am running away from slavery. And the person he was speaking with told him, but slavery was abolished 22 years ago. He said, but nobody don't tell me. Nobody told me anything. Nobody told me. I didn't know. Now, here was a gentleman, a brother, who had taken the first step, which is to celebrate himself, his individuality, his personality, and to stand up with his dignity, not to be oppressed. But at the same time, he also said, I did not wish to become part of any rebellion. I did not wish to be a part of any collective struggle. I did not wish to be a part of any organization committed to freedom. I didn't wish to be part of any community action. I just wanted to be me. The limitation the limitation of his consciousness. That therein lies the predicament which we are all faced with. At what stage, at what moment, do we sacrifice our individuality and individualism in support of the collective well-being of our people? At what stage do we cross over from the self to the collective? Last night, we rose in celebration of Congressman Conyers, and we used the metaphor of the slave ship, of a man who could have stayed in the safety of his professional career and life, but chose to enable himself to be captured, placed on that slave ship, because he knew that his services were required on the other side. This is very important, and I believe this is what we have been trying to do in the last 2 to 3 days, to move beyond our individuality into establishing our collective self for our collective struggle. And I celebrate each and every one of you for going beyond intellectual marinage into intellectual commitment for our collective struggle. We heard a great deal in the last 20 minutes of our identities and where we are from. And each of you identified your location. Well, we all came into this part of the world. We came as Igbos, and we came as Yorubas, we came as Mandingos and Fulanis, and we came as Susus, and we came in all different formations, but now we have been reformatted into Barbadians, Jamaicans, Americans, Canadians. We have been detribalized and retribalized. So now I stand before you not as an Igbo or a Mandingo, I stand before you as a baby. And what that says is that no matter what they have done to us and have continued to do to us, that they could shift our identities, our geographical locations, they can scatter us around the world, they can put us on ships and take us all around that space, at the end of that journey, we are saying our consciousness is still clear. We are still clear in terms of who we are and what we are. I am a classic case of this story. My ancestors came, yes, from West Africa and have worked on the sugar plantations of Barbados all of their lives. Even in my own childhood, I would take my grandparents' lunch into the sugar fields, into the cane fields. I have watched young white men on horses driving my grandparents into labor on sugar plantations. I saw it, and even in my childhood, I felt the injustice of it. Even in my infancy, I knew there was something wrong with this image. Then we were taken from Barbados to Panama to dig the canal. The Americans wanted us. The British no longer had need for us. And the Americans wanted us, and they put us on boats and they sent us to Panama. 300,000 of us taken from the islands to dig the largest canal. Then the canal was completed and we went off to Cuba to work on the sugar plantations. Then the British wanted us again. They were not finished with us. And my parents, like hundreds of West Indian working class families, were placed on boats and taken to England, where I grew up in the industrial city of Birmingham, where my family worked as industrial laborers. Once again, on the move from Africa to the Caribbean and now to Europe. All of our colleagues here from the European Reparations Union commission from Britain, we are all part of that leg. Where next will they take us? Where next will they demand to move us? Reparations and its discourse is about saying this is the end of the line. Tonight we say that we might have been scattered, but we are not confused.
Come on.
We are calling for a new beginning, a new consciousness, a return to the collective self. The organized mind builds organizations to serve and to express its consciousness. And this is why we celebrate the Institute of the Black World of Ron and Don. The mind that is rooted in its ancestral cosmology, ontology, and epistemology projects into time, and there it waits. Waits to build bridges beyond the present and the prisons of the time. This mind has conceived and given concrete form to the National African American Reparations Commission. Let us raise our spirits and bless this newborn and wish for it a fruitful and productive existence. We are happy to be your guests here in New York. You know, I was aware that in the old days, when Dr. King became exhausted in his struggles here in this country, sometimes when he became disillusioned with the headwind and the opposition, and he needed to recharge his batteries, many of you might not have known this at the time, but he would sneak away and go down to the Caribbean. He used to go down to Jamaica and Montego Bay and spend a few weeks in his African majority environment, and he would strengthen himself and return to the battlefront here in America. And that is how we have always interacted, moving between ourselves. And Dr. King would have come to the Caribbean to find peace and to find strength. We would be coming here to find work. But that is how it is. That is how it has been. You give us what you can, and we give you what we have. And then we go through time. Nobel Prize laureate Sir Arthur Lewis has made reference in his classic 1942 text, Labor in the Caribbean, that these 200 years of unpaid African labor must be addressed. We have also heard in recent weeks and months that the 150 years of post-slavery apartheid, the theft, the robbery, the persistent extraction of value from our communities here in this country to be accumulated for the enrichment of exploiters also has to be addressed. We are calling for a consciousness that goes beyond the conversation of reparatory justice. We are calling for a new 21st century moral order, a new 21st century economic order, a new 21st century development discourse.
And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.